You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. Good to have you with us on this Friday morning, July the 13th. Friday the 13th. It's our week in review for Friday the 13th. We welcome your observations from the news this week. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Every Friday after 8, we invite in two guests from different perspectives to talk with you about the big political news each week, and lots of news to discuss this week on Iraq and more. Last night, despite a veto threat from President Bush, the House voted to withdraw U.S. troops from Iraq by the spring. The vote of 223 to 201 to have U.S. troops out of Iraq by April came on the heels of an administration report that the Iraqi government has made limited progress in achieving a variety of reforms. The vote was mostly along party lines. Only 4 Republicans voted for it. 10 Democrats opposed it. The Senate will vote next week on a similar bill. Yesterday, when President Bush released this report on progress in Iraq, he also spoke about withdrawing troops too soon.
To begin withdrawing before our commanders tell us we are ready would be dangerous for Iraq, for the region, and for the United States. It would mean surrendering the future of Iraq to Al-Qaeda. It mean that we'd be risking mass killings on a horrific scale. It would mean we allow the terrorists to establish a safe haven in Iraq to replace the one they lost in Afghanistan. It would mean increasing the probability that American troops would have to return at some later date to confront an enemy that is even more dangerous.
President Bush yesterday talking about why he opposes withdrawal of U.S. troops too soon. He's going to veto, he says, this bill calling for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq by the spring. We'll talk about this, and we'll welcome your thoughts and questions for our two Week in Reviewers at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or talk@wpr.org. Let me welcome our guest, George P. Tack, former Republican state lawmaker, who is with White Hirschbeck Dudek Government Affairs. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy, and to the audience.
And Paul Soglin is with us, attorney for Epic Systems. Former.
No.
Oh, why do we keep on putting that on there? I'm sorry.
Because I'm a consultant for myself.
Well, I'll make sure that we erase that from my sheet. Former Madison mayor, and good morning to you.
Morning.
So,
good morning, Mayor.
Yeah. What do we think, Mr. Mayor, first, about the report on the progress in Iraq? I take 8 out of 18 benchmarks were being met satisfactorily, according to the president yesterday. Was that good enough?
I don't think so. And really, we've got to reexamine the very ancient thinking in the White House. I mean, as most of us know from childhood, our presidents are supposed to be very thoughtful and wise. I think we're at a point now where we understand that probably 95% of our listeners could do a better job in understanding what's wrong in Iraq, which is we cannot contain, whether we call it revolutionaries or insurgents or terrorists, we cannot contain people who are given the cover within the countryside and within the cities by the people who live there. This happened in Vietnam. It happened when the Soviet Union broke up into all the various republics, and it continues to happen today.
Yeah. George P. Tack.
Well, you mentioned the meeting 8 of 18 of the criteria satisfactorily. I don't know if anyone would say that there's a satisfactory progress being made on the part of the entire situation in Iraq, including the commitment on the part of the Iraqi government and the citizens of Iraq to move their country into the direction that would do a couple of things, essentially. Stop the insurgents, stop the terrorists from having their safe haven there. I think the president mentioned the, not likelihood, but the probability and even the expectation that safe haven would be there in Iraq for them if things deteriorate any further, or if the United States and the coalition and the Iraqi people fail in their mission, as I believe the Secretary of State called it, a work in progress at this point. Granted, there are problems. There are multiple problems, complex problems of a religious nature, of a political nature, of a nature relating to international terrorist activity in the region and support for that activity from some of the regional governments. It is a terribly complex situation. I don't think anybody argues about that. But I think ultimately the region, I think the country of Iraq, I think the citizens there will benefit from the involvement there of the United States and the international coalition as it began and as it continues. And ultimately, I believe the best will come out of it. It's a very, very difficult and complex situation at present.
It's a complex situation. It's a difficult situation. It's a situation that was not necessary. It's the result of a bunch of 23-year-olds who should have been drinking in bars, playing with guns and playing with bombs, and thinking that they could walk into the Wild West town with all their armaments and put a lid on everything. And until we get rid of that thinking, none of this is going to change. The great tragedy is there's really no one, Republican or Democrat, who's got a guaranteed way of putting the genie back in the bottle. The one thing we know is that as long as we are there, this is going to continue and it's going to worsen. This was the biggest, most expensive recruitment for Al-Qaeda that was ever imaginable.
Yeah, let's talk. Paul, I don't think I don't know if you're impugning the integrity and the morale and the commitment of our armed forces. You mentioned
soldiers. No. Don't.
You're talking. I'm asking a question. I'm simply asking a question, Paul. You're talking about 23-year-olds with weapons.
No, when I said 23-year-olds, I'm referring to the president and the vice president and the secretary of state
and all of the other
idiots.
I'm simply asking
the
question.
About.
Well, I appreciate that clarification. I've not heard
don't,
them.
Don't wrap yourself in.
I've not
in,
heard
in,
them.
In the heroism of those young men and women who were unfortunate enough to be led by idiots.
I appreciate your clarification. I haven't heard the president and the vice president characterized as 23-year-olds who should be sitting in bars rather than elected officials.
All right, let me play a clip of Senator Olympia Snowe, a Republican from Maine, one in a line of about at least a half a dozen, maybe more, Republicans who are defecting from President Bush and saying they are no longer going to support the current strategy, and Olympia Snowe saying she's going to sign on to the troop withdrawal amendments.
We have not seen the Iraqi government take the steps essential to achieving that national reconciliation. In fact, they're not even close. Secondly, even General Petraeus and our ambassador have indicated that it's going to take much longer than September. And, you know, we gave breathing room not only to the president to implement his strategy, the surge, which, you know, I didn't agree with initially because I didn't think it was going to work. But secondly, also to the Iraqi government. The surge, as Senator Reid indicated, was designed primarily to give the breathing room and as a final window of opportunity for the Iraqi government to achieve its political goals and has yet to accomplish those goals. And I think for those reasons, I don't think that we can waste precious time. And I think we have to move in a different direction.
Let me ask you, George P. Tack, do you agree with some who have called the defecting Republicans wimps?
I don't know. I wouldn't call them wimps. They're elected officials who, in some cases, are more concerned about their next election than they are the security of the United States of America. But I think in most cases, those who are now defecting, who see that particular step as being important, as they represent the interests of the people who elected them, it's much more of a political decision in my view than it is a decision to support or oppose a particular position that the United States government has taken and that the United States military has taken. One of the things I think of all the lessons we learned, there were many lessons, many very difficult lessons that we've learned in the United States government over the years. But one of the things that that is clear to me is politicians and those elected officials who are concerned about their next election should not be calling the shots in a lot of different areas, but most especially in the area of the operation of a military undertaking. And I think in many cases that's what's happening. People are looking at 2008 and perhaps 2010 as the next important hurdle in their particular political careers, and seeing that as the
objective. Why don't we just cancel the elections then?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Paul Sondland.
That's another interesting idea that I'm sure you've raised before, Paul.
I mean, come on. I mean, politicians are up for that's the very fundamental basis of our democracy.
Absolutely, I'm not interested in canceling any elections, like you're saying. I'm saying people put their political finger in the wind and say, "Well, you know something, I've got something coming before me in the next few months, and maybe we agree
that they're politicians and they put their finger in the wind. But the point is, for better or for worse, they've got an obligation to combine, following their own logic and heart and reason, along with that of the people that they represent. And it's a damn good thing we've got these elections. Otherwise, we'd be back in Iraq with even more silliness and more danger and more folly if it hadn't been for the results of the last election and the pending election. The point is, these guys made a mistake. They made a horrendous mistake. And the people like Snow, the senator we're referring to, she was lied to. She was deceived. The difference between the Republicans and Democrats in the Congress is that the Democrats admitted before the Republicans that they fell for it, that they were deceived, that the Bush administration lied. That's the bottom line.
Let me remind listeners that we are talking with Paul Sondland and George Ptak, our two guests this week for the Friday Week in Review. We'll take some calls from you after this break. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Good to have you along. Hope you stay tuned. This is our Friday Week in Review, talking this week with George Ptak. He's a former Republican state lawmaker, a principal at White Hirschbeck Dudek Government Affairs, and Paul Sondland, former Madison mayor and also a former Democratic candidate for Congress. Here is U.S. Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin speaking to the NPR program On Point earlier this week, talking about the politics of Iraq.
It's tragically late that these Republican senators and even some Democratic senators are beginning to take a stronger stand. It's still not strong enough. But what you're seeing is the house of cards, that this entire intervention was all about falling. And the only question is, are we going to get this thing done and get our troops out of there in a reasonable, quick manner, or is this going to drag on as people want to do this in slow steps to protect themselves or for political comfort? So it's a very significant development. I just think it's so sad that it's taken this long.
Now let's take Dan in Partyville. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Good morning. Mr. Sondland, I have a question for you. In light of the fact that Bush is rubbing his nose at the American people, it's clearly evident they want to be out of Iraq yesterday and end this insanity over there. And in light of the fact that he gave his buddy Scooter Liddy a get-out-of-jail-free pass, in 2008, do you think the American people are going to severely and I mean severely, punish these idiotic Republicans. I'll take your answer off the air.
I'd like to believe that would happen. However, as we know in American politics, there's more than the issues that determine the outcome of elections. There's two things that I see as important variables. One is simply the strategy of running a campaign. I mean, look at the way John Kerry was swift boated. I certainly see something like that on the horizon, regardless of who the Democratic candidate is. The second thing is that Americans' attention span is relatively short when it comes to comparing some issue like Iraq with other issues that may be more personal. I mean, one of the reasons we're not out of Iraq now is that, unlike in Vietnam, not a whole lot of Americans have something personal at stake in terms of serving in that country, whether it's themselves or it's a relative who's been drafted. So there may be other issues. There may be economic. There may be false issues like questions on choice that could, in certain states, trump the war in Iraq.
George Pita?
I know that elections run and candidates run, challengers especially run on more than one issue. But I would say that that it's the responsibility of those incumbents as well as those challengers to look at the bigger picture. Certainly, the situation in Iraq, the war on terror. And that issue, I would say, alone determined the outcome of much of what happened in the elections in 2006. I think what it needs to happen, and I'm not questioning whether the Dan in Partyville, whether the electorate will punish the Republicans for the war in Iraq, or for their position on immigration, or in the state sense for votes that have been cast by elected representatives on the state, or frankly local, state, or federal level. But it's incumbent upon the candidates, challengers, and incumbents to look at the bigger picture, and the electors have to see. Either by a voting record in someone who has been in office, or by the commitments and the campaign strategy that that a challenger might bring forward. Does this person better represent the overall interest of the community or of that particular individual, and then cast their votes accordingly?
Let me just add a bipartisan view of this, which is both the Republicans and the Democrats have proven themselves to be pretty good at shooting themselves in the foot in recent years. So we've got to also add the ineptness of both parties as a variable here in terms of the outcome of the election. To that, there's also the fact that there might be a third-party candidate. Who knows who's lurking out there? But that could also have an impact.
Certainly could. It has in the past.
Pat in Oregon is with us. Hi, Pat.
Good morning. My comment is on the surge. Now, the surge has been going on for 6 months. And one of the things that I've only heard talked about one time in the media was that part of it is that we set up these little outposts where we have Iraqi soldiers and American soldiers set up, and they patrol a particular area. They stay together. Well, what it's been called is really babysitting, because when we're with those guys, they don't go out at night. They don't have hit squads. They don't have all this stuff going on. And the only way this is going to work is if we stay with them forever. That this whole thing is not going to work. There's no way that we're going to have a Western-style democracy when 65% of the people are one persuasion. they're never going to let the other, you know, parts have their say.
Do you know what you're describing?
We're in the middle of a mess, and it's not going to get any better. I'll listen to your comments off the air.
What he's very accurately describing is actually how we got into the war in Vietnam. This was the U.S. presence in the period of roughly 61 to 63, where we had the U.S. military advisors, supposedly in a non-combat role, escorting and babysitting the South Vietnamese troops. And, of course, we know what happened there. We get the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, and then we admit that we're in a full-scale fighting war. I find it kind of irony. I never thought about it. But, the strategy that we're using, we're winding the clock back in Iraq to how we got into Vietnam.
Let me get a caller in, then George Pitek can respond to both. Eric and Appleton, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. My biggest question is the talk of the politics of the war. I just have this feeling, and I'd like the guests to comment on it, that let's say Hillary wins in 08, I don't think she'd pull the troops out if they're still there. I think that nobody wants to be viewed as the person that lost this war.
Yeah. George Pitek?
Well, I think there's some truth to that. But at the same time, the war is going to be, if not the only issue, certainly a critical issue as the campaigns move forward through the caucuses, through the primaries, and into a year from now into the full-blown election campaign. One comment about the surge, if I may, Pat's comment from Oregon. The surge, he mentioned that it's been in effect for 6 months. Well, I beg to differ with that. The term surge was used perhaps 6 or 8 months ago, but the surge itself is only recently and maybe not even now fully in place. So to judge the success of the war effort there on using the term surge and its full implementation is, to me, somewhat premature. Absolutely. Question some of the other tactics. Question some of the Iraqi government's ability to respond and their willingness to step up and take over their own war effort. But to say that the surge has been in effect for 6 months and to question its ability to deliver is to me inappropriate because it is not even yet fully implemented. Concerning the politics of the war, Eric's comment is an interesting one. The commander in chief, the current commander in chief, is taking a position different from the commander in chief in 1965, as Paul mentioned. But allowing the military commanders to assess and to judge and to strategize and to enable General Petraeus to come back in September with his assessment. Of course, he's assessing every day. He's taking intelligence reports. He's taking reports of his field generals and colonels and troops there. To bring back the message to the president and to others in the military establishment. Will any president in 2008 immediately withdraw? Well, we won't even be there in 2008 if the Democrats have their say, which of course is not going to happen. Yeah. One of the things that's a particular bother to me is. I think I wasn't around in 1941 when the United States was attacked by the Japanese, and that entire war situation was again, terribly complex. But I see some similarities between that war effort, certainly some in the Vietnam War, and now in the Iraqi and the war on terror. The liberals and the peacemongers back then had their approach. But I'll tell you, the American people had a very, very strong response to the attack on Pearl Harbor and the attack on the United States of America there. It's been a little different here because the media has had its input, the liberals and the peaceniks have had their input, and the response by the American people has been somewhat different to the attack on on the World Trade Center and to the attack on the United States of America, different because of the media and different because of the influence that the media has had and that the peace lovers have had.
We could probably talk all hour on that, but we need to move to some other issues, and Paul Soglin needs a chance to respond to that. So, Paul?
Well, whoever's president in 08 will have a very difficult decision about bringing the troops home. It's more going to be a question of safety, I think, than anything else. I don't think Republican or Democrat in the White House is going to worry about the legacy of having brought the troops out of Iraq as much as they're going to worry about what they can do diplomatically to help contain terrorism all over the world, particularly in Iraq, after this adventure is over. I'm not even going to go into any analogies with World War II. I just don't think that there's anything comparable there, whether we're talking about how American viewed the war in Europe compared to this one, or how the nation and its leadership responded. It's an insult to FDR and that generation.
Let me one more call on Iraq, and then we have so many other issues to cover. Louise in Hillsborough, hi, you're on the air.
Thank you very much. I'm kind of responding to the comment about a short attention span, and nothing personal. I have a son in Iraq, and I have been deeply opposed to the war from the beginning. It was obvious to me, and I'm so angry that we've been lied to. And I know that, I guess I just know that I can't believe that we continue to do this. There's so much personal. So many people I know have had injured or children that were killed. I can't believe there's a short attention span. I can't believe we don't look in and aren't hearing every day about the Iraqi lives that are being lost. And I can't believe, I really think that the American people are working up to a rage on this subject, and I think we need to be listened to.
The great tragedy of this is twofold. First, let's add to these comments. Also, when we talk about the attention span, the treatment that our veterans get when they return. Some of the more conservative responses to the war are hard to explain and fathom, but the one that really befuddles me is how the people who send these young women and men into combat simply disregard their well-being when they return. Let me throw out a number. When there's 10 casualties, 10 deaths in every congressional district in this country, you know, we're talking about almost 4,500. We hit 4,500 in Vietnam, and we just kept going until we got to 45,000. We're at 4,000 now. The big difference, very tragically, about our nation's response to the two wars is that it took the draft, it took the Selective Service System to bring so many tens of thousands into combat and into incredible danger, whether it was from bombs or if it was from chemicals, to launch the kind of daily vigilance that was needed. This war, not only this war, but yes, the loss of lives of the children, of the families, of the civilians, the people we brought into danger, is just staggering.
You failed to mention, Paul, the loss of lives that took place on September 11th at the World Trade Center, 3,500 American citizens.
What does that
citizens.
Have to do with Iraq other than we strengthen those terrorists? Those what terrorists had nothing to do with the war in Iraq, nothing, until we invited them in.
I beg to differ with you, but I think what
wait,
we're seeing
wait,
I think
we can't
what we're
do
seeing
this.
Is
even the President of the United States now acknowledges that they lied, that there was no connection between September 11th and Saddam Hussein.
I think the jury is out on that.
The jury's
that today.
Not out. Colin
I'm
Powell.
Sorry, if it would be appropriate, I think, to address Louise's comments. She has some concerns, and I share those concerns. It's important that that the families and the those who are serving
in our military are treated properly, are cared for, certainly while they're in the war zone in harm's way, and also upon their return. And I have a son that's in the Marine Corps today, and we pray for him regularly, and ask God for strength and protection for him, and also hope that the Congress supports those troops and keeps the war effort in place, in a sense that since we are there, we ought to do everything we possibly can to give the military an opportunity to do what it does best, and that is to actively and aggressively attack the enemy and do what it can to wipe out the enemy. And that's where my support is.
We're talking with George Petak, a former Republican state lawmaker, and Paul Soglin, the former mayor of the city of Madison, our two guests this week for the Friday Week in Review. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. We will move on to other issues, including gut feelings on terrorism and some state news as well. I see we have a caller who wants to talk about SICKO, maybe the CNN debate with Michael Moore. We'll see. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Stay tuned. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn after 9 o'clock, and John and his guest will discuss this interim report released yesterday by President Bush regarding the 18 benchmarks spelled out by Congress earlier this year as a part of the Iraq spending bill. The Iraqi government is making only satisfactory progress on 8 of the benchmarks, and John and his guest will talk about that some more after 9 o'clock. We are reviewing the news of the week, which includes progress or lack of it in Iraq and other related issues. Our two guests, George Petak and Paul Soglin. And here's what Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff had to say earlier this week.
All these things give me a kind of a gut feeling that we are in period of that I have a specific threat, you know, that I have in mind right now, but that we are entering a period of increased vulnerability.
And let's take Jim in Milwaukee as our next caller. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. What I wanted to talk about today is the continuing propagandizing of the American people to overestimate the threats issue in the context of two newspaper things, one from the Milwaukee Journal and one from the Chicago Tribune. I counted the Milwaukee Journal Q section, all the TV listings of movies, and I counted 16 films this week that dealt with threats of various sorts to the United States, including Red Dawn, where high school guerrillas take on invading troops.
Yeah.
Again, a constant stream of propaganda.
Do you think the government is making these movies, Jim, to keep us scared?
I'm not saying that the government dictates all these movies, but the themes of these movies certainly propagandize people to see threats to a greater extent than they are.
Yeah, I thought that you were going to talk about, many have criticized Chertoff for saying, I have a gut feeling that we're going to get hit by terrorists this summer, as a way to just scare us and to change the subject. Paul Soglin, is that what you thought?
Well, it's a little disturbing that we spend billions of dollars for security and we're going to rely on his gut feeling to determine the level of danger. I hope he was just being a little careless in his use of words rather than being manipulative and trying to instill fear in us so that we would then rally around the president in the war in Iraq. I'm disturbed by things as recently as the reports this week about how easy it is for anyone, because of a lackadaisical federal government, for example, to obtain radioactive materials. I mean, that report just came out this week, or how we have failed again to really do much about checking the cargo containers coming into this country. There is so much that can be done, and yet it seems that this administration would rather fight terrorism, unfortunately, with words rather than with deeds. Mm-hmm. And the kinds of deeds that would be effective.
It seems to me that the administration, while I'm not going to sit here and defend everything that that the president does stands for or that Mr. Chertoff does either, the administration is dealing with a different breed of Congress these days, and to put the entire burden onto an administration, I think is inappropriate. Especially in light of the approach that the partisan approach that is taken on virtually every position on every matter, whether it's homeland security, whether it's port security, whether it is container inspections, the whole immigration situation, partisan rhetoric after partisan rhetoric, day after day. And an inability on the part of the majority in the Congress to work cooperatively to a mutually acceptable end, and that is homeland security, that is securing the borders, that is responding to not only the gut feelings of the director, but also the evidence that's there that that security should be heightened, and that the level of imminent danger is expanded. Look at what's happened in Scotland. Look at what's happened in London. Look at the other terrorist attacks. I don't think they're idle threats. I think the evidence that's been noted recently that al-Qaeda is strengthening not only in Iraq but also in Pakistan and elsewhere. There are reasons to be concerned. There are reasons, and I, you know, I don't buy into the Jim's comments about these threat levels being exaggerated. Some have criticized the United States of America and the military and the administration for poor response to issues that were in place before 9/11. Well, here we are trying to respond and trying to be a little better prepared in the future. And I think we are going to be better prepared because of the effort in Iraq. It's not going to solve all the problems because we've got security issues, we've got intelligence issues around the world that need to be addressed. And we should have a Congress that's supporting that cause, not criticizing it every chance it gets.
Cindy Sheehan was in. Oh, go ahead, Paul.
There's some foolishness that's going on here, though. I mean, why does this president and this administration expect to go free of criticism on Homeland Security when, by every measurement, whether it is in terms of population size, whether it's in terms of targets, no matter what we measure it by, they refuse to provide New York City with adequate funding, but they're sending them money to Wyoming in terms of preparing this country as defense mechanism against terrorists. The other thing I want to point out, since you mentioned Pakistan, is we continue, as many commentators noted several years ago, we continue to destabilize governments that are sympathetic to us. We've got to worry about the Egyptian government. We have to worry about the Pakistani government now, all because we have done such a marvelous job of encouraging everyone from the very wealthiest to the poorest to join al-Qaeda.
I'm going to take another call who's been waiting, Dave in Wanakee. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. In a way, this is related to the discussion. I want to talk about Michael Moore, who was on CNN to discuss his movie Sicko. And prior to him being on, the CNN had a little hit piece on Michael Moore from Sanjay Gupta, in which Dr. Sanjay Gupta trotted out a list of facts that he said were not accurate, but in fact turned out to be accurate. So Michael Moore went on very angry about having, you know, been sandbagged again, and discussed how the news media has let down America in regard to holding this administration to account, in regard to holding pharmaceutical industries and other and insurance companies with whom they have financial relationships. They seem to have a conflict of interest in getting accurate information out to us regarding our health care.
Yeah. Do you agree with that, George Ptak?
I don't agree with much that Michael Moore says or does, but I think it's the responsibility of the American people to hold their elected officials accountable for the information that they're given. We have an opportunity every 2 years or 4 years to, or 6 years in some cases, to go to the polls and support the people that that should be representing our interests. And that is representing the interest in our health care, in our, well, by the way, I don't support universal or government sponsored and health care, but I do support the accurate record keeping and the dissemination of information. But I don't see any tie-in really to Michael Moore in any of this discussion that we've had this morning, personally.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it raises the question, though. We pride ourselves as Americans of being the intellectual giants of the world, the greatest in scientific research, other, of course, than when we declare that the theory of evolution doesn't work and that there's no living creature on this planet prior to 16,000 years ago. But, you know, putting aside that, we pretty much wrap our arms around our own genius, scientific efforts, our compassion, our wealth, our resources. Why the hell are we basically at the bottom of the list when it comes to industrialized countries in terms of infant mortality rates, in terms of the health of our country's people? Why are there so many other nations that are not industrialized that take better care of their people than we do? Hello?
Let me transition into the state budget with this discussion on health care. The Assembly passed its version of the state budget this week. It took out the universal health care proposal that the democratically controlled Senate put in it last week. George Ptak, you think the Assembly did the right thing?
Well, I think the Assembly did the right thing in a sense that it stood up for the taxpayers in the state of Wisconsin, which is a commitment that Speaker Hipsch and multiple of his colleagues on the Republican side have done for their entire time, certainly their time in the majority party here in the state. They have established, I think, what I would say is a benchmark in terms of a negotiating position, not unlike, may I say, the position that the Senate Democrats established. There are, I would say, in not every case, but lots of cases, 180-degree differences on in the approach. And of course, now it's incumbent upon the leadership and those that they represent to hammer out the differences and to establish a budget that that will function as soon as possible. They've agreed. The leaders have agreed to begin the meetings soon. I don't think there's an actual time frame established as yet, but. They know their responsibility as elected officials to enact a state budget, and I think we've got these two divergent views, very very divergent views that ultimately will come together and establish a budget that will be supported by the people of the state.
Paul Sullivan?
Well, both parties in both houses have had their fun now. Tweaking one another, putting some things in the budget or taking it out, which was designed to cause hysteria in the other house or on the other side of the aisle.
Seems to be working, too.
they've been very good at it for years. The problem is this. When they come down to converging and joint finance to work out a budget, the question is where do the millions of people of this state fit in? In other words, are we simply going to be pawns that are moved around the table? Or are they really going to be thinking of our best interests in all of this?
Let me bring in one caller because we're almost out of time and she's been waiting quite a while. Sheila in Stevens Point. Hi, Sheila.
Well, my comment, good morning. My comment is right in line with this budget discussion as you're ending up your hour this morning. And one of these interesting inflammatory things that seems to have gotten flung is that one of the representatives from Green Bay introduced legislation that in the budget that would eliminate funding for the law school, state funding for the law school.
Yeah, State Representative Frank Lassay says Wisconsin has too many lawyers.
Many lawyers. I don't know if this is the same legislator that was from the Green Bay area that also introduced legislation some time ago saying that teachers could bring guns to school.
Yep, that's the same one.
You got to wonder sometimes about people that know.
Isn't this a great country?
Now, so both of you don't think that the legislature is going to cut funding and end the University of Wisconsin Law School, do you?
I doubt it.
Well, you know, the thing is this. I mean, you start with his premise, which is that there's too many lawyers in the state. Even if it's true, does that mean that shutting down the law school is the greatest value we as Wisconsinites have in terms of resolving this problem? And yes, this is the guy who wanted our teachers to be able to carry guns in the schools. Unfortunately, he keeps getting reelected. Well, his constituents certainly are entitled to do that. Let's just hope that he's not sitting at the conference room table.
Yeah,
I doubt that that the proposal to defund the law school will move forward, but. It's an example of the divergence, as I said,
yeah.
of opinion, and now it's incumbent upon those leaders, Majority Leader Robson, Speaker Hipsch, and their committee members, to work through the more demanding and more difficult. Issues that relate to health care and education and transportation issues, the environment, and everything else contained in the budget.
We have to end it there. We're out of time.
You're Billy Goat, not ours.
Paul Soglin, George Petek, thank you very much for being with us. That's the end of this edition of the Friday, July 13th, Week in Review. Thanks to Christina Taylor and to Karen Prager for producing the hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.